are for our Bible class hour. I appreciate everybody's patience with me about me coming in and out, kind of blowing in and out with this lesson. It's a little bit difficult, really, to learn that way when you are so syncopated and interrupted, and I've done that to myself and done that to you as well. So that usually means that we have to review a little bit more than we would like, and then that's not good either. But as we get to this point, I think this is very difficult for us just to stick with the Gospel of John. I've told you that before. This is one of those parts that if you just go through the Gospel of John, it's very rich, very detailed. It has details that the other Gospel writers, the synoptics, do not have, which is a good thing. But really, it is hard to put in your mind the events that are taking place, the impact that they have, and all of those things without now bringing in some of the other Gospel accounts. And so as we do this, we are going to kind of move. We will use John as maybe our backbone and our structure. But we will, and then we'll bring in some of the other passages from the synoptics to try to add that color and the detail and some of the things that are happening. Because sometimes we actually have to infer from John's gospel what's happening, but we read the other accounts and we find out what the background is. With that, I would like to, we remember in Luke 22 and 53, Jesus has said, "But this is your hour in the power of darkness." Several things have happened here, just we have talked about Peter's denial, but let's just run through this quickly just to kind of get us back to where we were, and that is speaking about Peter and the two tragedies that are going on. We find out from Mark's gospel in Mark 14 and 66 that the palace that they are at, where Caiaphas and Annas have kind of shared two different big, large structures, you would think that they were massive and they were just a grand style today, even today. And you can ask yourself the question, these were the religious leaders of the day, and yet what? They are living like kings. And so this Judaism has long left all of the patterns and the things that they were to stand for from the very beginning. By this time, it's very corrupt. Annas and Caiaphas themselves are very corrupt, making as much money as they can, living like kings, and everybody else is peasantry. And we find that out when they send out the officers to try to get Jesus earlier in his ministry. And they came back. And they, well, where is he? Never a man spoke this way. And they said, what does this rabble know? They don't know anything. They're peasants. They're nobodies. They're low class. And now Jesus is brought before them in the middle of the hours of the night. And he goes to Annas first. That's the one that John talks about. And then he goes to Caiaphas. Somewhere in here, as Jesus is standing there before Caiaphas, as they're taking their fists and their hands and they're slapping him and hitting him, and then they're spitting on him. And when this is happening, this tragedy of the Son of God standing there quietly, taking all of this abuse and shame, there's another tragedy that's taking place outside. And that is in Mark 14 and 66, he says that the courtyard where this was is down below, where Jesus would have been held up in the palisade part of it. But this is down below in the courtyard where they have a fire. It's cold at this time of year, maybe unseasonably so. You could look off into the distant mountains. You could see the snow on the peaks perhaps. These are soldiers not only from Caiaphas and Annas and the high priest, but these are soldiers also from Caesar. These are Roman soldiers that have been added there on all of these big feasts. They're given to the high priest to try to keep this rabble down. They're always afraid of the tumults. We'll talk about some of those in a second because they were constantly and consistently happening, with the Jews being very stiff-necked, even under the Roman yoke. And so these things are happening, and Peter walks up, being the courageous man that he is. He's already taken a slice of somebody. He comes up into this area that he's not wanted. John goes in and enters in, and he's known to the high priest. What a curious statement that we'll find out about someday. And yet now Peter is brought in there, and he sits there, and we find out our first, this foreboding when he sits down and he sits amongst them. And we talked about that, didn't we? About sitting yourselves in an environment more than unfriendly, but it's in the middle of the enemy camp. And as a follower of Jesus, you probably have no business putting yourself in that situation, because then the fall is all yours. And Peter sits down in the fire where he's unwanted and he's not among friends. In fact, he has the northern accent. I just heard that the other day, somebody making fun of the northern accent. Well, in Judea, it's the same way. They're separated by Samaria, and you have the Galileans, and they're a little bit rough, not quite as educated. They're more intermingled with the Greek culture, and they have an accent. And there he sits among these soldiers and the maids. And John tells us what? He's sitting there with an individual that is kin to Malchus, who he's already tried to slice his head open. And now they hear him as with his speech as he begins the denials. Why? Because the firelight shines on his face. The maid begins to intently look at him and look at his and begin to see, and they can tell, oh, she's looking very intently. Hey, this is one of them. You ever been called to those? You're one of them. Peter says, oh, no, I know not the man. But he says it in that Galilean accent. And then his speech pattern, they said, that gives you away. You're one of them. You were with him. That's the man in the garden. He saw his kinfolk just to get sliced there. And he looks at him again. He's like, you were in the garden. You know, it's amazing here in the end. Well, before I get to the end, let me talk about this. There's a denial, but there's a lie. We go through this and we think the two things are the same. It's not quite true. You could deny Jesus all day long and never lie yourself. But he's put in a situation where his denial is verbal and he's asked if he knows the man. And so not only is he denying him, but he is lying. Dr. Walter Porter was a Harding professor for many years. He was a psychologist. He wrote a book on the mental illness of sin. Interesting enough, it was accepted pretty well in the psychological realm. They kind of recognized that a lot of these things we call diseases or mental illness, you know where they really come from? They come from sin. We're an addictive behavior, addictions. Not all of them are that way. We have chemical imbalances. We have all kinds of people with problems emotionally. But many of these things that we read about and see just are at the end of the rope of sin. After it takes over somebody's life. You know, in the 1970s, we came up with that. Hey, alcoholism is a disease. Well, why'd we say that? Well, we wanted to take away the stigma of it. And we wanted to say, well, it's some kind of medical condition, as if you can't help it. Well, it may be a disease, but it's at the end of the line of what? Sin. It's a disease, but it's a disease of sin. Just like every other addiction. I know a preacher that was caught up in so many sexual scandals and misconduct. And then finally, when I talked to him, he said, well, I want to be a counselor for those that are addicted to these sexual things, you know, and the lusts of the flesh. I thought, you know, what a preacher you make. Here he had just split and crushed four different congregations, one of them being of 600 people in Nashville, with his conduct. But he couldn't. I said, you know what, why don't you step aside and let somebody else take the lead in the church? You worry about your own life. But he still wanted to be up front, still wanted to be a leader, still wanted to be that man, you know. And he thought, well, this is my niche now. I can counsel other people on this problem. But addiction as it may be, it's still sin. And lies are the worst. I've tried to tell my children as they grow up, there's nothing worse than you can say the lie. As soon as somebody accuses you or thinks that you're lying, that's a reputation you may never get back. Your character is marred and maybe for good with those people that you've lied to. Even if they're wrong, if they perceive it as a lie. And Peter here, following the father, that's Satan, of all lies, he's lying. And what happens when you lie once? I know, because I've done it. My mother asked me again. I had to lie the second time. Why? I certainly didn't want her to think I was a liar, and I wanted to cover up the first time. And Peter knows that if he comes out with the truth now after the second denial, then what? They're going to not only know you're a liar, but you're weak. You're a weakling. You sat here and lied to us. And now you're going to lie again to cover up those lies, and it just keeps on going. And then in the end, Peter resorts to a great tactic. He's told by Matthew and Mark that he what? He begins to curse and to swear. You know why that's a good tactic? So I told my children this. If you don't want people to think you're a Christian, you know what the easiest way to do that is? You just let vileness come out of your mouth. You just curse. You talk like the people at work. I'm so tired of hearing deacons and people that present themselves in front of the church as somebody, and then you hear them talking as if they're at work with the, you know, down in the pits or something, working on engines, and you know, just kind of being one of the boys, and you just look at them like, what kind of Christian do you think you are? What are you talking about? What, you want to talk like that at school? And then you want to come in here and act like you're somebody different? You think you're fooling anybody? That's the easiest way to deny Jesus. And believe me, when you curse and you swear, I'll believe you. You're no more one of us. You're no more in the camp. And that's what Peter does. Now, when Peter is maybe placed under a threat of death, and he's asked if he knows Jesus, is denying Jesus really a sin? I heard somebody up in Afghanistan once that was caught and was put in a little village, and you know, that's what some of them wanted to know, if he was a Christian. He didn't have any whole hard, you know, Christian convictions, so he was able to say, no, I don't really care. But, you know, he was kind of in that situation where maybe if he'd have spoke up, he'd have said the other thing. I heard a Christian say this. Well, what good are you if you deny Jesus and then they just lop your head off? Are you going to convince them? You going to convert the Muslims? You going to have the Taliban go, wow, that was pretty neat. Maybe we ought to look into this. You going to be able to go home and nurture your family? You going to be able to go on some future mission trips or do any of this if you get your head lopped off? And we can start talking to ourselves and justifying that maybe if you're not there to convert somebody, why would you go that route? Why would you open your mouth? Maybe just be quiet. You know what Jesus said when he said, Peter, Satan's asked to have you to sift you like wheat. But I've made supplication for you that your faith fail not. Now, we can probably get in a discussion that'll last the rest of the week. Did Jesus pray for something that wasn't going to happen? That couldn't happen? That Jesus' prayer himself, the Son of God to the Father, could not be granted? That Peter would not fail? We're not going to get into that, but what did he say? That your faith fail not. And when did that happen? When he made the denial. And then when he said, in what? But when you turn again, establish the brethren. Means, Peter, you're going to go off into a far distant land and separate yourself from God and all the other disciples in a way that is going to shame you. But when you turn back and you come back, establish the brethren. And that's exactly what Peter does. Denying your Lord is sin. And when he does that, the Lord turns and looks upon Peter. We see that in Luke 22 and 61. Mark has something interesting to say in Mark 14 and 72. You know, a lot of people keep saying, you know, the Gospel of Mark is just bare bones. Everybody else copied from Mark, added a lot of detail. Mark's just really this, just kind of the skeletal thing. It doesn't really have that much. You could read the other three and really get everything out of it. That's not true. Mark is short. It's to the point, but I'll tell you what. The Gospel of Mark has words in it from the Greek that none of the other Gospels have in it. He uses words that are so strong. So he says something in three words, and somebody else like Matthew says it in six verses. But when Mark says it, it's strong, and he says, and then Peter went out, and it says he went and thought thereon. That's not the Greek. It's Peter went out and covered himself in shame. He just wanted to bury himself. He's not just contemplating. You and I do that. No, Peter goes out and just... He doesn't know whether he should just, you know, hang with Judas off the side over here or what. He wants to bury himself. That's what Mark says. We get to the timeline of events. We have talked that there are six different trials. There are three Jewish. There's Annas. There's Caiaphas, informal in front of the Sanhedrin. There is the formal in front of the Sanhedrin when they finally come together early in the morning and they pronounce the judgment. Remember what that judgment was. Remember why they rent their clothes. Remember why they send Jesus to Pilate. They'll forget that soon enough. And then there are three of the Romans. That is Pilate. We'll talk about the first trial in front of Pilate. And the second one is in front of Herod as being a representative also of the state. And then the third under Pilate. And then it'll be done. If we look at the timelines, this is just an idea. I look at this and I don't want to get into the endless questionings that Paul talks and warns Timothy about. But the reason it might be good in your mind to find out when these events are occurring is because many people will come to you as skeptics and say, have you ever read the gospel accounts of the death, burial, and resurrection? And they don't add up. The times are different and the day is different. That maybe on first glance could present a problem to the skeptic, but really in the end it does not to those who are searching for truth. And you could put these things together. We have said that John uses a probably, most probably, F.F. Bruce would disagree with me, but B.F. Westcott and others would say, no, he uses a different timeline. It's the Roman timeline, because when is John writing? Oh, he's writing years. Not only after this, but he's writing years after the destruction of Jerusalem. He's not writing to the same audience at all. He's writing to people that are dispersed all over the globe at this point. These things are so far removed. They're no longer following a Jewish calendar, a day or a time at all. Synoptic Gospels, different. But we have so many different timelines. If you were to do a study in this alone, you would throw down some markers. In Matthew 27, he says, when morning was come, the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to the death. In John 19 and 14, it was the preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. We find that to be about the six in the morning. Sixth hour for the Jewish time would have been what? Noon. And we can't really have that because Jesus is on the cross at noon. We have darkness over all the land from noon till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We have him coming down off the cross after three, and we have him where he has to be prepared and thrown in a hasty tomb before six, about six in the evening. And so we know that when John says 6 hour, he's most likely talking. And there are other places in his gospel where that actually adds up as well. The woman at the well being one of them. Matthew 27 and 45, he talks about the 6 hour being darkness over all the land. And of course, Jesus cries out on the 9th hour. Just some of those things. This is just an idea. This is just Scott's idea of trying to get so that you can see this timeline of events. Let's talk about what happens now. We'll go through this, and I'm not quite sure how to go through this best without really losing everybody, because this is somewhat difficult, but the overview here, we'll talk about the probable year, probable day, and then we'll go through. You could see here, this is where John is really, you know, many people, I'll just tell you now, there's this big controversy of when this happened. We think pretty much that Jesus is on the cross on Friday. But whether or not that is the Passover day or if the Passover was the day prior or not is the big controversy. And depending upon who you read or whatever, and I tell you what, I'm not going to hold to anything. I will tell you that I would think that Jesus is on the cross on Friday. I believe that was the Passover day. I believe when the lambs were being killed in the temple and they were crying out and you could hear the baying of the lambs, then there was the cry out of Jesus on the cross. He is our Passover and he has been killed. That would agree with Revelations and the Passover and the Lamb and all of the things that we're told that he was going to be. Why would he, when he did have the Passover or the feast, he's going to do something because it's important to him to institute the Lord's Supper. And if he did it after 6 p.m. on Thursday, when would that be? That would be the Passover day itself. He still would have the Passover with the disciples, but we're only told that the disciples were having it. There's no kind of record that the rest of the city is having it at that time. John goes into extreme detail about the rest of the population and such hypocrisies and ironies as they didn't want to step foot into the praetorium because they didn't want to defile themselves so that they might eat the Passover. He goes into great detail on those things. It would be hard to submit that. So we'll talk about that, the probable year, and then also who Pilate is himself. Here's another way to look at it. You know, you could take a harmony of the Gospels and you can lay them out. Maybe four columns. Let's say A.T. Robertson. You could get that's really good reading, by the way, to do that and scan back and forth. And probably your software and your iPad has the same. You could also take McGarvey's way with Pendleton, and what they did is they just integrated all of it. They said, if you just want to sit down and read through all the gospel accounts, and we're going to integrate all of them, you'll have kind of the timeline, you'll have all the details that happened. But that would be very difficult to then study a particular gospel because they've got them all meshed in. One of the ways you can do this is to take a gospel, let's say John, and say, we'll use him as our main backbone. And then when he lacks detail or there's an inference, like for instance, when Pilate brings him in, he says, art thou a king of the Jews then? Or art thou a king of the Jews? We don't have anywhere in John's gospel where that's what the accusation was. But if we go over to Luke 23 and verse 2, what do we find? Oh, well, he's been perverting our nation. And he's forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar. And he says he himself is Christ a king. Now we see the accusation, the charge. That's actually charge number 2. So what I have done is then take John as a backbone, and then we'll bring in some of the detailed accounts from the other Gospels when we need to supplement it. And if you were to take this and make a note of it and just read through this by going through these passages like this, Luke 23 and 2, by the way, should probably be in a parenthetical note out to the side of John 18, because this right here, verse 2, actually takes place within this. So I have not written it well. And then you would come back here, and then somewhere in 37 and 35, you find this. Luke 23 and 5, and that is where he finds out he's a Galilean, and he's a rabble-rouser. So then you go to Luke, because that's the only place, 6 through 12 there of Luke 23, where the trial is in front of Herod. And then you would come back to John, and when he comes back, there's some details in Matthew about Pilate's wife. And then some of those details, like Mark has the best description of who Barabbas really is. If you listen to John, he says he was a robber. Okay. He was a robber. He was a thief. But I don't think you'll know what he actually stole. Hopefully we'll get to that. And that's kind of interesting. And then best description of Barabbas there. Pilate's wife, we just bring those in. But then we pick up the reading here. Herod sent him back and he found no fault in him, obviously. And then John 18, 39, he starts offering up Barabbas. Now, Pilate becomes desperate at this point. He is desperate to get out of crucifying the righteous man. And we'll see that again and again. I don't care what Bill O'Reilly says. I don't care what those people in Hollywood say. This is a Jewish thing. Don't ever forget that. And that's what the apostles said. And we'll talk about that in Acts chapter 2 and everything else. In Acts chapter 4, he said that. And they said, by the hands of lawless men in Acts chapter 2, you crucified. He's the lawless men are the Romans, but he's accusing the Jews. And it happens again and again. It's not proper politic, but that's the reality of the situation. The Jews today, by the way, they would have you not want to read. I flew with a captain the other day. He was an Orthodox Jew. So he pulled out the Gemara in Aramaic and began reading it and verbally going through his prayers. He probably was used to people just shutting down and looking out the other side of the window, but I thought that a rich opportunity. I began to ask him questions. I talked to him until we went on break, and then we came back and I asked him more, and pretty soon he was done with me. But I told him, I said, the next time we go to London and you go to the synagogue, I want to go with you. Or the next time we lay over in Denver, you go to the synagogue, I said, I would really like to go with you. He was amazed at what I was asking him because he thought, why would a Christian know anything about the history of the Jews? I thought that was interesting. What he didn't want to tell me is what I did know about what it said in the Gemara and some of these things, the Talmud that was written in 200 AD about Jesus. By the way, if you ever start losing your faith and your faith begins to falter and you say, well, I wonder if Jesus is really made up. Does he really live? Because I've heard this from certain people like Richard Dawkins. Well, Richard Dawkins, He certainly hasn't gone to Israel and tried to debate the Jews. The Jews, they know Jesus lived. Now, they don't believe in him. They don't believe that he's the Son of God. They hate him. They could try to tell you to get you off their back. Well, he was a good man. He just, no, that's not what their literature says. Oh, no, every one of these charges is true. He was a liar. He was an insurrectionist. He was all these terrible things. That's what it says in their literature. And that Jew knew that when I started asking him those questions. And the interesting thing is these people that were there at the time know that Jesus lived. They didn't believe in him. They didn't follow him, but they know that he lived. You will never find an Orthodox Jew saying that Jesus didn't exist. That's not what they say. They say they know he lived, and they read about him, and they tell you all about him. It's just like anything else, like some of the other historians that, you know, Josephus or whatever. So very interesting to go to outside literature and find out. They're not going to deny his existence, not at all. Not like these people today that just seem to think that maybe history doesn't matter. Anyway, that's another way of looking at it right there. Let's talk about Pilate just for a second. Here's the inscription right here, found in 1961. It has Tiberius's name on the top. You can almost see that, really, if you were to look at this. You could pull it up on your iPad or anything. And then there's Pilate's inscription as well. Pilate takes over in 26 AD. And when he does, right away, he lets the Jews know who he is. When Pilate comes in to take over, he is kind of an unknown. He is not a governor like you and I would think. He's not a statesman. He was not elected to office. He is not there to take care of people. He is a military dictator. Much like in that land, in that time, that's what those people were. He's a military dictator. That's the way Tiberius gets to the throne after Augustus. He's not Augustus's true son. He was adopted by Augustus, but he is up there. He's already fought in Gaul. He's fought in France. He's fought in Germany. He's fought in Belgium. He's done a great thing. He doesn't even really want the emperorship, and he comes back, and he's the last choice. And then he takes over. When Pilate gets thrown on there in 26 AD, it's not Tiberius that puts him there. That's important for you to remember. Tiberius should have been putting him there, but he didn't. He was put there by Sejanus, he's one of these conspirators at the very top of the emperor, and he kills Tiberius' son. He's in cahoots with his wife, who is partaken in all kind of lascivious acts and lustful acts and shameful things, and Tiberius is just, he can't believe it, so he leaves Rome. Tiberius leaves Rome, and he goes off to his villa, seaside villa, and he stays and never sets foot in Rome again because he's so disgusted by politics. At that point, you could see that they hated Tiberius because in Rome, they wrote so many terrible things about him. They had this faction that kept talking about how terrible he was and his sexual perversions and all these things that were going on, all the stuff that comes out to be not true. But at this time, Tiberius is not wise enough to understand that Sejanus is not his friend. And Sejanus is kind of his right-hand man. And then he's over there kind of pulling the strings and calling the shots. And he appoints Pilate in 26 AD. Pilate rolls into Palestine, and what's the first thing he does? He goes over there, and what was the symbol of the Roman legions? The eagle, right? Where the carcass is, the eagles will gather. That's what Jesus said. He's talking about the destruction. When Rome comes in there, Pilate takes these eagles and he sticks them up in the temple and all around Jerusalem. How do you think that goes over? Yeah, not well, because the hypocrites and all these people like Annas and Caiaphas, they certainly are not going to bow down to idols. They'll kill an innocent man, but they're not going to bow down to idols. And that's idolatry. And so now they start complaining, and they gather together, and they march on Caesarea. It's about 2 or 3 days' march, and they go over there. They gather in mass, and Pilate looks at him, and he's like, listen, I don't like you anyway. And he surrounds them with soldiers, and he goes, I'm just going to start the blood running. Get out of here and disperse. And the Jews lay down. They say, no, we're more activists than you can even imagine. We are not leaving this place. You kill us if you want, but we are not going to have Roman symbols over Jerusalem. So at the very last, as it barters back and forth and a few people are killed and all those things are going on, finally he tells the soldiers to disperse and he lets the Jews go and he takes them down. But he absolutely despises the Jews and has no respect for them at all. Well, shortly after that, he does something else. He sees that Jerusalem has a water problem, kind of like Wichita Falls, Texas or something. They just can never get enough water. So he's going to do an aqueduct project. He's going to bring water in from Solomon's pools. And you can see those today where he starts building these aqueducts. But well, how's he pay for these? Well, he's not going to use his own coffers. So he's going to use the Jewish coffers out of the Jewish temple. This is where it gets interesting, because to this day we're not quite sure, but there's strong evidence that he is in cahoots with Annas and Caiaphas, and they actually sell him and let him have these coffers so that now they'll have something on Pilate. And Pilate acts like the rest of the time that that's possibly true. So that he's able to, he doesn't just march in there with soldiers and take it, but somehow it ends up with Pilate. Pilate begins to pay for the project. The people are outraged again, but who are the people that are outraged? It's not the Judeans, it's the Galileans. And the Galileans are these rabble-rousers that come down for these feasts, and they're absolutely enraged, and they surround Pilate's palace, and they begin to chant and scream, and they're just frothing at the mouth. And this time Pilate's like, not this time. And he surrounds them with soldiers, and then he finally says, he goes back and he gets another garrison of soldiers, and he goes, you go out and get some Jewish garb on. Cover your faces and put your sicari, the knife, put it in your belt. Go out there amongst the people. And when I give you the word, I want this to stop. And that's exactly what happened. They pull out the daggers and they just start going at it. And these Galileans are screaming and falling. Does it remind you of a passage in the Gospels? Somebody go to Jesus at one time in Luke 13, 1 and 2, what'd they say? They start telling him about the blood of the Galileans that were mingled with the sacrifices. Here's a good lesson for us. Does Jesus go down that road with them? Or does he turn it into a teaching moment? Isn't that amazing? They're talking about his kinsmen being murdered and this awfulness of what's happening in the political realm. But he turns it into a teaching moment. He goes, oh, do you think that they are greater sinners? Because those things happen to them. And then he comes out with Luke 13 and 3, which you all know. Lest you repent, you shall all likewise perish. And he says it again in verse 5. But that's what he's talking about. And so now, that's a couple of things that Pilate has done. And then the third thing is, now he takes some shields and he makes those and he dedicates them to Tiberius. And he puts them up in the city and he puts them around the temple. And the Jews just start going ape again. They're like, no, we're not going to have Roman shields hanging all over the Jerusalem and hanging up in our temple. So they start the same. So this time they start writing, and they write to Syria, and they write to Vitellius, who's the governor of Syria, who has power over Pilate, which is kind of interesting for us to think about, but his realm is much bigger. And they write to Tiberius, and he's over there in his villa on the seaside, and he comes back and he sides with the Jews. In fact, he's absolutely so angry about it. And he basically says, Pilate, I really have heard not good things about what's going on in your realm. We didn't put you out there to stir them up. They're a volatile keg ready to go off. We know that from their history. These people are just mad. And you keep prodding them. You're poking the kitty. And so Tiberius says, take the shields down. And he doesn't like Pilate, and he's like, I'm watching you. That's what I'm doing now. I'm watching you. And so they're not on good terms at all. Now, is that going to come into play later? There's four major charges made against Jesus. We'll go through those. The fifth one that actually puts him on the cross and makes up Pilate's mind is what? It's not even a charge at all. It's a political power play, and it goes back to what Pilate is afraid of with Tiberius. And at that time, Vitellius does. He says, I've had enough. I'm going to send you back. And all those things are written up in the history books. It's kind of interesting. All right, so we know enough about Pilate here. Not a great statesman, although a lot of military leaders were, like Tiberius himself, and certainly Augustus was great, incredible. If you ever read about him, you wish you'd have a politician coming back like him. Trial before Pilate. Probably the year 30 AD. Some people say 33. We put Jesus, you know, his ministry 30 to 33. That's probably not true. We have him born in maybe 4 BC. We have Herod dying in 4 BC. We have to have Jesus born before Herod dies. We know that. And then we go along, and now this gets a little bit complicated, but we have some inscriptions that we found in Caesarea, and it has to do with Lysanias, the Tetrarch of Abilene, along with Tiberius, and along with Tiberius's stepmother, or the wife of Augustus. And because they're mentioned at the same time in the inscriptions, and the inscription maintains the date that's 29 AD. You have all those three together. Now, who else has all three of those together, at least two of them? And that's Luke, right? When Luke is talking about in Luke chapter 3 and verse 1. And so now we have some timelines. So we're going to say Jesus is, at this point, is probably about 30 AD. Also realize, if we say 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, and Caesar took over, and Tiberius took over in 14 AD, you say, well, that's 29. And that's when Jesus started. But if in the Roman way and Jewish way at the time, if Tiberius takes over in December and he goes into a new calendar year in January, how long has he been in power? He's already done with 1 year. And then if he goes into March 15 years later and then he stops there, they're going to count that as a whole year. So when this happens, you can move this back to about 27 AD easily. In fact, the outside date is really about 26. And like I said, this is another one of those things I'm not going to argue with you about because it's not that important. But it makes it easier later on in the calendars when they do get a lot more stiff and firm if we have him on the cross in 30 AD. Pilate goes here without the praetorium. Jews won't step foot on the praetorium because they want to eat the Passover. They don't want to be defiled. Now, they'll scream out in lies to try to get him on the cross. They'll try to get him crucified, but they're not going to dirty themselves with stepping on the Roman pavement, which is not even really in the Old Testament. You go back there and kind of look. You kind of see where it comes from, but it's in the Targums, and it's in the oral traditions handed down, but they're going to save themselves. Just like when Caiaphas, when he had the tire on his head, and he said, holy unto Jehovah. Had holy unto Jehovah at the same time they were hitting and spitting on Jesus. Same thing with the praetorium. Just kind of an amazing thing. But now starts the turn of events that are somewhat emotional for us as Christians, looking at exactly how humiliating and how terrible these things are. But Pilate has to go out to the Jews. He's got Jesus now inside the praetorium. He has to go back outside to talk to him. And now they give him charge number one. This is kind of interesting. They give him charge number one, and charge number one is, well, he's an evildoer. We've already had a trial. We found him as an evildoer, and that's all you need to know. And so Pilate comes back, and so he has a very, very political answer because he does not like them. He perceives for envy that they had moved, that he had delivered him up. He knows what's happening here, and he's thinking, you've got to be kidding me. There's no quester to sit on the seat, so I'm going to be the judge, sit on a seat. This is a Roman trial. I stand out, and this is not saying, hey, what do you got against this guy? This is like the gavel goes and goes, okay, bring the accused in. What is the charge? And they say, oh, we've already found him guilty. He's an evildoer. He's an evildoer. So what does he say? Well, take him yourself then. Judge him according to your law. Why are you bringing him to me? You don't even want to bring a formal charge against him. What do you think this is, some kind of kangaroo court? I'm done with you and your people and your games. Take him yourself. Oh, we have a law. We can't put anybody to death. That was true. The Romans had taken that from them. Even though the Jews would go ahead and put people to death, we'll find that several times. But they're saying, no, we can't kill anybody ourselves. And because if the Jews would have killed him, what would they have done? They'd have either stoned him or even more rare, but they would have strangled him. But they're not going to do that, and so they're going to try to turn him over to the Romans. And how do the Romans execute? Crucifixion. That's why the verse says, and this would fulfill what Jesus said about what type of death he would die. In John chapter 3, he said the Son of Man would be lifted up. In John chapter 12, he said, and if I be lifted up, I'll draw all men unto me. Talking about the crucifixion. And then what question did they ask when they said that? In John 12, I think it's about verse 48. I could probably be wrong on that. But about that time, they say, what? We have read that the Christ will abide forever. How do you say that the Son of Man be lifted up? Then they ask the question. What is the question? Who is this Son of Man? I want you to remember that question. Because it's going to be answered in these trials. And it's not answered by Jesus. They're asking the question, who is this Son of Man? And Pilate's going to answer it for them. So he wants a formal charge, but he's an evildoer. At the same time, we read in Luke's gospel in Luke 23 and verse 2, we find out that they're going to make a formal charge now. They see that that's not going to stick. So they say, okay, we need to get back in the political realm, something he'd be interested in. He's making himself out to be a king. And so Pilate comes back in there. art thou a king? You the king of the Jews? Now, all the other gospel accounts say that his answer is very simple. He says, thou sayest. And what do we say about the Hebraic way of saying thou sayest? Well, thou sayest because it's true. That's what you say, because it's true. I am a king. And where do we read about? But then in 1 Timothy, when Paul is talking to Timothy, and he says, this is the charge that I give to you to make that good confession, that what? Jesus made in front of Pilate, the good confession that he was a king. And so, John goes through the details. This is where you would miss out if you were just reading Mark or some other gospel, but John gives the details of a much more detailed answer before he gets to the final answer. And so he's answering this question and makes this confession. But the first thing he says is, did others tell you this, or are you, is this something from yourself? That's a little hard for us to understand exactly what's happening here. Why would Jesus say that? It's a little bit difficult, but it's kind of like saying, you know what, you have a formal trial here. And if the accusers are saying, I'm a king and of the Jews, why am I on trial here? Did people tell you this? Are you curious? Is this the charge you're making against me? Where are my accusers? What exactly is the charge? And so Pilate knows this. And when Pilate comes back, he's not asking for information. We say, oh, well, am I a Jew? Your own nation have turned you over. What have you done? He's not, no. Am I a Jew? Your own nation and high priest have turned you over to me. Pilate's done with this. He doesn't even want to be in this situation. What have you done? That's what he is. He's getting really angry. He's getting aggravated. He wants to know, how are you coming back with me? What kind of answer is that? I just want to get to the bottom of this. First of all, I don't care about the king of the Jews. Don't really care. What I do care is if that king is going to lead them in sedition. But I haven't heard that yet. That's what Pilate's thinking. And then he says, hey, I need to know, what have you done? What's going on here? Jesus is not going to really satisfy him. But he goes on with 18 and 36. Very famous verse, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight? That I should not be delivered unto who? The Jews. That my servants would fight, that I would not be delivered unto the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. You know, boy, there's a lot of churches, call themselves Christians, throughout the country, throughout the land. They're still looking for a kingdom on earth. And Jesus is trying to tell Pilate, listen, they have made the same mistake, but my kingdom is not of this world. And why would it be that that's a good, what would be that the great confession? See, Pilate recognizes it. Pilate recognizes that he's a little bit more astute than a lot of us are today. And he said, what did I hear? Art thou a king then? Well, to this end have I been born. To this end have I come into the world. That I bear witness to the truth. Remember one of the major themes of John, that I would bear witness to the truth, and everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. And Pilate's like, okay, look, I'm not interested in philosophical questions. I'm not interested in theological questions. I'm not interested in these local politics of the Jews unless it starts to affect me in the Roman Empire. And so he takes that and he's going to go out and he says, I find no crime in him. This is beyond him. He cannot even understand while they're looking to put him on the cross for these things. Why would that be thought of as the great confession? You see, you have a lot of religious leaders today and talking on the television, even this morning. They don't even recognize that when Jesus' kingship is a great confession because he is king and high priest today. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 says he was what? He was going to be on the right hand of God until all of his enemies have been put under his feet. When Jesus was in Matthew chapter 22 and he was asking the Sadducees and the Pharisees, he said, whose son is he? David, whose son is he? Who's he talking about? And they're like, well, he's David's son. He said, well, how did David in the spirit call him Lord when he said, I said unto my Lord, sit down my right hand till I make thine enemies the footstool of thy feet. So Jesus, the king, is going to be sitting on the right hand of God until the enemies are made the footstool of his feet. 1 Corinthians 15 said he's going to reign until he has all of his enemies put under his feet. In Acts chapter 2, he said he's been exalted and sits on the right hand of God. In Hebrews, he said he sits on the right hand of God until he makes all these enemies the footstool of his feet. Therefore, if he sits on the right hand of God and he reigns he's reigning till he puts the enemies under his feet, he reigns on the right hand of God. And where does the apostle say he is? He is on the right hand of God. So he's on the throne. He reigns today. You know, you hear all that time, oh, no, I believe that he's king. He's reigning, but his kingdom hasn't yet come. Listen, Pilate was even smarter than that. Kingdom and kingship go together. That's why he said, oh, wait, what did I hear? You have a kingdom not of this world. Are you a king then? The two things go together. Revelation 3:21 says he is sitting on the throne right now today. That's why when Jesus said, thou sayest, I am a king, it's a great confession that says he is the Messiah, he is the prophet, he is the king, he is the Son of God, and he's going to reign from that point on. And that's why he told them, very soon, in your lifetime, you will see the glory of the Son of Man coming with his angels. Talking about that kingship, the church, the kingdom that he purchased with his blood, Acts 20 and 28. Well, I didn't get very far today. I'm sorry about that. Thank you so much for your kind attention. I appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you next week.